Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sarah Anderson of the Institute for Policy Studies, who discusses the ongoing fight by labor and environmental groups to block congressional passage of Fast Track in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. A report on a rally organized in New Haven, Connecticut, challenging Yale University, the private sector, and city government to create living wage jobs to meet the basic needs of the city's unemployed residents. And Shama Sawant, a member of the Seattle City Council, who talks about her successful 2014 campaign to win a $15 an hour minimum wage in Seattle, and how that victory has inspired similar campaigns across the U.S. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Women's advocates in Argentina say one woman dies from gender violence every 30 hours, with a death toll of 1,800 women killed in gender violence over the last 7 years. Despite strong laws against domestic violence, including outlawing femicide, the crime of killing a woman because of her gender, advocates complain the laws have not been enforced. In early June, over 200,000 people, outraged at the recent murders of women and girls, marched on the National Congress in Buenos Aires to demand an end to the epidemic of gender-based violence. In a statement, march organizers declared, "Femicide is the most extreme form of violence that covers every social class, beliefs, and ideas. It's a word which reveals the ways in which a society sees something as natural, which isn't." Protesters used the social media hashtag Ni Una Menos, or Not One Less, to mobilize protests in 80 cities across Argentina and Latin America. In spite of strict gender violence laws, advocates in Argentina say women are hurt by widespread misogynist public attitudes and the lack of official statistics on gender-based violence. A survey by the Thomson Reuters Foundation places Buenos Aires sixth in the world as the most dangerous public transit system for women. Moreover, most police officers lack training in detecting gender violence. The Los Angeles Times reports the suicide rate for female veterans is soaring, 6 times higher than the rate for other women in civilian life. In fact, the number of suicides for women vets now rivals those of men, who currently make up 90% of the nation's veterans. Recent research from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs shows younger female veterans between the ages of 18 and 29 take their own lives 11 times more often than non-veterans. In the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, women soldiers endured unprecedented levels of casualties. Moreover, many women serving in the military experience isolation and harassment. Most men, in contrast, experience high levels of solidarity and bonding with their colleagues while in the military. 24-year-old Katie Lynn Chisena, who was raped while in the U.S. Navy, took her own life after she left the military. Although she received treatment from the Veterans Administration in San Diego for post-traumatic stress disorder and depression, Chisena expressed near-constant fear of her attacker, who was never prosecuted by Navy officials. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch has put the clout of the U.S. Justice Department behind new draft legislation granting Native Americans equal voting rights. The proposed Tribal Equal Access to Voting Act would place election officials in each tribal community that requests it, reducing the long travel times Native American voters often have to face to cast their ballots. For example, Native American voters in the Duck Valley Reservation in Nevada face a 200-mile round trip to vote on Election Day. Most elections are organized by state and local officials who run polling places. For years, Native tribes have gone to court to win equal voting access under the Federal Voting Rights Act. Indigenous peoples were first granted citizenship and voting rights in 1924. But local governments have repeatedly put obstacles in place that limit the Native American vote. Despite their small numbers, Native Americans exercise political clout in states such as South Dakota, Montana, and Alaska. Higher turnout among Native voters in Alaska in last year's election helped elect a Democratic governor and lieutenant governor. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The battle in Congress over President Obama's goal of gaining congressional passage of Trade Promotion Authority, also known as Fast Track, a necessary prerequisite for later ratification of the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, or TPP, hit a roadblock when members of the president's own party rebelled. In a critical vote on June 12th, the House of Representatives rejected a measure to grant financial aid to displaced workers, one of three elements passed earlier by the Senate, which was needed to advance Fast Track. In a vote of 302 to 126, the majority of Democrats joined a number of Republican lawmakers to defeat the free trade package. On June 16th, members of the House voted to give itself six more weeks to schedule another vote to rescue the president's free trade agenda. Public disagreement between the president and congressional Democrats on the issue of the proposed 12-nation TPP secret free trade deal has centered around concern on the outsourcing of good-paying U.S. manufacturing jobs overseas and broken promises on trade agreement provisions that are designed to hold trading partners accountable for adhering to high labor, environmental, and human rights standards. Another controversial provision, called investor-state dispute settlement, allows multinational corporations to initiate lawsuits against local, state, and federal public health, environmental, consumer, and labor laws, as well as court rulings, if a claim is made that they impinge on business profits. Your reporter spoke with Sarah Anderson, director of the Institute for Policy Studies Global Economy Project, who discusses the fight by labor and environmental activists to block Fast Track in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, with a focus on the issues of trade, democracy, and corporate power.
I think that the main message I want to put out first is that this was truly a historic day last Friday, because this was a fight that really united broad swaths of the progressive movement. Almost all the unions were there, but not just unions. It was also environmental, faith, immigrant, food safety, you know, NAACP. There was really a broad coming together in opposition to this whole trade package, up against the Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable, the Wall Street lobby groups. And so the fact that it's just stalled alone is a really big deal, and it was painful to watch a Democratic president fight so hard on an issue on the opposite side of most of his constituents. But I'm hoping that it'll be a real wake-up call, and that they'll, you know, think that they need to take a different approach to trade. But, you know, down to the minutiae of, you know, the legislative maneuvering, there was a vote in the House. This had already passed through the Senate as one unified bill, but they broke it up into several pieces on the House side with the understanding that if any of those pieces failed, the whole package would go down. And so the first vote was on the worker assistance for workers who lose their jobs as a result of trade. Democrats usually renew this without any real controversy, but this time it went down big time, more than 300 votes against it. That meant that the big issue of the day, this fast-track authority, which is what the administration wants to grease the wheels to get new trade agreements through Congress, that would fail as well. But to show momentum, the Republicans did bring it up, and they got a majority in favor of it, but it was still purely symbolic because of the defeat of the worker training funds during that first vote.
What's the next step for opponents here? Has it really come down to a second vote that I've read is being scheduled to retry that displaced workers fund measure that didn't pass the first time out?
It's very confusing what will happen from here on out. They are talking about bringing that back up. How they think they can switch something like 80 votes within a short period of a matter of a few days, I can't imagine. But for the opponents, it's continued pressure, especially on Democrats who voted for the fast track piece of the legislation on Friday. And so these are the people who are really going to be, you know, on the target list of a lot of the groups that are opposing this legislation. And it's gotten very intense. I just don't know if I've ever seen anything like this, where you have the labor movement threatening to really try to scuttle the reelection bids of Democrats who are voting for this. So it's really become the most intense legislative fight I've seen on these issues ever.
If Fast Track passes and the Trans-Pacific Partnership down the road also receives passage from Congress, what is it that you and many of the other opponents are most concerned about?
Well, the way I'm seeing it, I feel like the intensity around this vote is not just about Fast Track. It's not just about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's about the whole trade agenda and beyond. I think what we're seeing, the intensity of this, is a reflection of kind of the current zeitgeist. People are so much more sensitive these days to issues around inequality, to feeling like the rules of the economy have been rigged in favor of the 1%. I think a lot of that is coming out, is being unleashed in this debate. But what it will do if we do get this new Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a trade pact among 12 countries, with the largest being Japan, and some smaller countries like Vietnam, is a continuation of an approach to the global trade rules that really leads to a race to the bottom. I mean, I wish so badly I could believe the rhetoric coming out of the Obama administration right now about how this is going to be good for workers and worker rights and democracy. I don't think the workers in Vietnam or the people under forced labor in Malaysia are going to gain anything out of this. There's no enforceable labor rights in the package. And so it's just going to be continued pitting workers and communities against each other as these big global corporations take advantage of the protections they get under these agreements to push down labor and environmental standards.
That was Sarah Anderson, director of the Institute for Policy Studies Global Economy Project. For more analysis on the current battle over free trade, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On June 11th, a large and boisterous crowd of over 500 gathered in front of City Hall in New Haven, Connecticut, for a march demanding good-paying jobs for city residents. According to U.S. Census data, there are 83,000 jobs in New Haven, 47,000 of which pay a living wage of at least $20 an hour. But only 9,000 of those 47,000 jobs are held by New Haven residents, and only 2,000 of them by residents in the city's low-income neighborhoods. The unemployment rate for blacks and Latinos in New Haven is more than 2.5 to 3 times higher than that of white residents. Yale University, the city's largest employer, has 13,000 employees, fewer than a third of whom live in New Haven. The day before the march, a top Yale official said the university would hire 500 residents over the next 2 years, which is apparently more than its current rate. But many marchers were skeptical that that constitutes a significant change in Yale's practices. The city's job training program, New Haven Works, is a joint project of local government, Yale, and the city's largest labor unions. Although the agency has trained 500 New Haven residents for jobs in construction, healthcare, hospitality, and education, very few graduates of the program have been hired by New Haven employers. The march was organized by New Haven Rising, a group affiliated with the Connecticut Center for a New Economy and Yale's labor unions. After the rally at City Hall, one group of marchers wound their way through downtown to the construction site of Yale's two new residential colleges on the edge of a low-income African-American neighborhood. Another group walked to Yale New Haven Hospital, the city's other biggest employer. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who was at the march, recorded speeches, including one from New Haven Mayor Tony Harp, and conducted interviews with some participants, including Kimberly Hart, who works 10 hours a week for a city nonprofit group.
My name is Kimberly Hart, and I'm here, and I'm a member of Mothers for Justice.
Are you a New Haven resident?
All my life, 53 years, yes.
So why are you here?
Well, I am here because I heard there are 83,000 jobs in the city of New Haven, and not nearly enough of the jobs are held by New Haven residents. And I just find that appalling. It's not fair. So that's why I'm here.
Mayor Tony Harp expressed her support for the goals of the march.
There are three things I want you to know about your rally this afternoon and your demand for jobs for more city residents. First, I stand with you. Urging local employers to make New Haven jobs available to the unemployed and the underemployed New Haven workers. And to add to their workforce as they're able. With this in mind, we've already heard, New Haven Works has identified and pre-screened over 500 trained, qualified, and eager job seekers who are city residents and ready to step up, step in, and help these local employers. Second, I'm in step with you as we walk the path toward this shared vision. Together, we will navigate the pitfalls and obstacles we encounter on this path. We'll work to reroute bus lines and address other transportation needs to connect more people with jobs. We'll help those with a criminal record so they're not deprived of a level playing field. And we'll educate and train workers so employers have skilled and experienced workers. Third, we do not and we will not walk this path alone. New Haven is rich and very fortunate in its talented and diverse array of economic opportunity. Conscientious employers and workers, each and all of these elements will and must walk together along this path if we are to reach our goal and generate more jobs for city residents. We must act now. We will work together, you and I, but the employers must do more. Yale University, Yale New Haven Hospital, and other large employers, including the city of New Haven. We must respond to the jobs crisis with more than incremental solutions. Bold leadership is required from New Haven's employers if we are to solve a crisis of these proportions. And when they do, and I know they will, together, we will move New Haven's economy forward so that more opportunity is available for all New Haven residents. We must act now.
That was Mayor Tony Harp. Dominic Dickey was leading chants during the high energy march.
We want our jobs to come back to the city. We want the money to come back to the city. We want equality to come back to the city. So we have to keep fighting. We want to keep doing this. We want to keep the job flowing to our residents.
For Between the Lines, I'm Melinda Tuhus.
Learn more about the Rally for Living Wage Jobs organized by New Haven Rising by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Shama Sawant's election to the Seattle City Council in 2013 made history, as she was the first socialist candidate elected in Seattle in 100 years. As a council member, she fought for and delivered on her campaign promise to make Seattle the first major American city to pass a $15 an hour minimum wage. The former software engineer, originally from Mumbai, India, ran for office advocating increasing the minimum wage taxing the rich, and reimposing a rent control ordinance. In her surprising victory, Sawant defeated Richard Conlon, a four-term Democratic council member and past president of the city council. Sawant, who studied economics in North Carolina, moved to Seattle in 2006 and became involved with Socialist Alternative, a political party originally formed under the name Labor Militant in 1986. Before running for office, the activist helped organize the local Occupy Wall Street movement when it spread to Seattle in the fall of 2011. The victory for a $15 minimum wage in Seattle has inspired activists in other cities across the country to push for their own $15 wage hike. San Francisco was the first city to pass a $15 minimum wage law after Seattle, where 77% of the city's voters approved a ballot measure on the question in November 2014. In Los Angeles, the nation's second-largest city, Mayor Eric Garcetti signed their $15 minimum wage law on June 13th, where an estimated 600,000 workers will see pay increases over the next 5 years. Your reporter spoke with Shama Sawant about the current campaign to bring the $15 minimum wage to cities across the nation and the larger issue of rising income inequality.
The idea of $15 an hour as a minimum wage for some of the hardest working, lowest paid workers has caught like wildfire around the nation. And much of it started with the initial victories in SeaTac and Seattle. SeaTac is a city neighboring Seattle where the international airport is located. And the airport workers there and the labor movement, and particularly SEIU, really pioneered that struggle following the many walkouts of fast food workers in the winter before, you know, in November 2012. And this has been a historic achievement. And we have to own this history. We as working people, as social justice activists, everybody who's on the ground fighting to build a better world, we have to own this as our victory, because the corporate media is writing its own narrative that this was won because of the largesse of the big business executives, because of big business politicians, because of corporate politicians. And the reality is that the victories in SeaTac and Seattle, just as any other social change victories that will be won in the future and have been won in the past, were won in the teeth of the opposition, the massive opposition of big business entities and the politicians that are loyal to their interests. And so the way we won 15 in Seattle and the way the whole process unfolded, both in SeaTac the year before and in Seattle last year in 2014, was working people building really powerful coalitions, fighting movements, fighting campaigns on the ground. I think it's important to draw some generalized lessons from what we've done. One is, if you fight, if you build organized collective struggles of working people of color, of people on the ground, the people who are oppressed and marginalized, you can win. It is possible to win. So let's not make the mistake of being pessimistic. We won't win every battle, but we can win a lot. And we can build a struggle not only for winning reforms like an increase in the minimum wage, but we can go ahead and raise the banner of a fundamental social change. And now we've seen Los Angeles has just won $15 an hour. It is remarkable that the Los Angeles City Council members themselves, when they passed this, said, hey, New York should be next. They looked to the other side of the continent and said, New York has to be next. We know that the 15 Now campaign in New York is gaining ground. And I have no doubt that if we really continue our determined struggle, we can win larger gains, including the federal $15 minimum wage.
What was your experience like after the $15 minimum wage that you won in Seattle made headlines across the country? Were you deluged with a lot of inquiries and asking for some advice?
We did receive a lot of inquiries, and I would say deluged in a good way, meaning we want that to happen. We don't see this as a parochial ground that we're breaking. We want the victories that workers have achieved in Seattle. We want the example of our successful socialist city council campaign, which was run on a genuine and unambiguous anti-corporate, pro-working class mission. We want this message to spread. And we know from our study of history and, you know, what's happened in the past, is that social movements don't remain isolated. Just by the nature of them, they social movements are infectious, meaning if we won victories in Seattle, it is automatic that workers in other cities and indeed worldwide will look at that and try to understand what worked there and what can we do here? How can we win victories where we live?
You know, certainly congratulations are in order to you, the activists in Seattle, activists in Los Angeles, and people working all around the country, including New York City. But obviously, we have a huge problem with rising income inequality. The $15 minimum wage hike city to city will improve the lives of many people, no doubt. But the bigger fight is, how do we address this larger issue of income inequality? It's not a simple check off one box and you're done. There's so many things that have to be changed in the country to really effectively address economic inequality. And I'm sure that's something you and the folks that you work with in Seattle have thought about such a long time.
Absolutely. There is no question of what you're saying. And I'm really glad you raised that point, because not only, I mean, there's two things. One is just looking at the facts. Inequality is entrenched and expanding, and it's an insidious force that is making life virtually unlivable for a majority of Americans, and in the context of them living in a country that is the wealthiest country in the history of humanity. That is what's stunning. The complete failure of capitalism and American politics to have offered a decent standard of living to all its working people, and having hoarded trillions of dollars in the hands of the multi-billionaires, the CEOs and the executives, that shows you how utterly incapable capitalism and our current system, our current social structure has been to deliver even the basics of a decent life for people in the United States. And so there's no doubt that the statistics are really stark. And so the fight for 15, in people's minds and also in terms of statistics, what we have to fight for has not just been about 15. What has propelled people into action, what brings out this passion and fire among people, this latent anger, is not just the desire for 15, but a desire to really wage a war on the status quo, on inequality.
That was Shama Sawant, member of the Seattle City Council and a leader of the successful campaign to raise her city's minimum wage to $15 an hour. For more analysis and commentary on the nationwide movement for a $15 minimum wage, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.